Welcome back, folks. You know, I'm always looking for interesting things to talk about that are occurring in our country as our economies mature. They are changing. They're very dynamic. We have a whole lot of things that impact employment. I came across a study that was done by Professor Chuck Baird. He's a professor of economics, emeritus at California State University, East Bay, and it was done with the Cato Policy Analysis about the reformation of federal laws relative to private sector labor unions. And it was really interesting as to the history of how this came about, where we were, how popular unions were. In back in the 50s, they had reached a saturation point of 33% of non-farm labor were in unions. In 2024, it's 5.9%. Obviously, something's not working for them, and he's here to talk to us about it. Chuck Baird from California State University. Chuck, welcome to the show.
Hello. Good afternoon.
So thank you so much for joining us today. I found the article really interesting, brief history of it as it relates to unions. And you start out that saying America's labor markets, interactions between employers and employees are generally based on a voluntary exchange. Employers make offers of wages and benefits, and workers offer their services at terms that are suitable to them. And obviously, this whole thing of unions kind of disrupts that whole policy, right?
Yeah, it sure does. In the 1930s, there was a serious turn against freedom of contract, especially in labor markets. It began pretty even before the 30s, but in the 30s, it started with Herbert Hoover, of all people, who signed into law the Davis-Bacon Act and the Norris-LaGuardia Act. And then it was topped off in 1935 by Franklin Roosevelt with the National Labor Relations Act. My perception of all of these acts is that it violates basic principles of freedom as understood by the founders of the Constitution of the United States. However, in 1937, the National Labor Relations Act was enacted in 1935. In 1937, the U.S. Supreme Court, in the Jones and Laughlin case, upheld the constitutionality of the National Labor Relations Act, and that became known at that time as the switch in time that saved nine, because Franklin Roosevelt had promised or threatened to stack the court if he couldn't get what he wanted out of this Jones and Laughlin decision. And so he got what he wanted by a 5-4 vote, which I've always called a real day of infamy, perhaps on the same level as Pearl Harbor.
So, they've lost a significant amount of representation, but they are still very much involved in a number of critical industries, critical services, and really became in favor relative to government employment.
Yeah. The government sector unionism question is parallel to, but substantially different from, the private sector. I've also done work in the government sector union field. I'm working on something now, in fact, trying to argue that the entanglement exception to the state action doctrine could be used to declare the principle of exclusive representation unconstitutional. Maybe that's just wild thinking by this old professor, but nevertheless, I think I can make a case in that regard. Yeah, in the private sector, the unions have maintained a firm hold in a lot of legacy, old manufacturing and manufacturing undertakings like automobiles, for example. And the principal reason for that is another horrible aspect of the National Labor Relations Act. And that is, once a union is certified by majority vote in a representation election, it never has to stand for re-election. It is assumed always then to be a unionized firm, no future elections necessary. So, as I say in this paper that you're referring to, consider the union members in the U.S. auto industry, the big three. Not one of them who are members today and actively employed members today ever voted in favor of union representation. Why? Because when the union, the United Auto Workers in this case, when the union got its certification back in the late 30s and early 40s, that was it. No future elections. Imagine we have Joe Biden or Donald Trump, whatever example you want to use, they get elected and they are there for life, never having to face re-election. That's an obscenity. And that is what the case is with the National Labor Relations Act today.
What was the thinking that this was the best course of action? I mean, you know, hindsight's 2020. We look back, we've seen all kinds of abuses, mismanagement, misspending of money, internal theft, federal investigations, people going to jail. I guess it's a lot easier to do all of that when you never put the organization at risk, because it's guaranteed and protected by the government to be in existence in perpetuity.
Yeah, it's not only a guaranteed and protected. It is endorsed and promoted and imposed by government in many ways. The original thinking. I mean, put this into context. The early 30s, what was going on? It was the Great Depression. The Hoover blunders grew out of the misunderstanding of economics. That's true of most presidents. They don't understand economics. But there was a misunderstanding of economics. And they thought that that competition was the cause for the Great Depression. And so the cure was to eliminate competition, keep prices high, and we will have bliss forever. But that's economic nonsense. It may have been well-intended. I don't want to ascribe evil intent here to Hoover or even to Roosevelt, but they were simply wrong. As I say in the paper, when you don't understand the underlying economics, you're going to end up pursuing bad, counterproductive policies.
Now, when we look back as well at hindsight being 2020, you make an observation where union supporters say that they seek, and I quote, take wages out of competition.
Correct.
So now, when we look back.
Yeah, sorry.
Go ahead.
Take wages out of competition. As I say in the paper, correctly understood, unions are labor cartels. Now, let me get into that a little bit. Economists define cartels as this: a group of people or entities who would ordinarily be competing with each other, who get together and agree that they're not going to compete with each other, and they're going to present a united front and a monopoly price. Now, that's a perfect fit for unions, right? Mm-hmm. Workers usually compete with each other, making offers. And unions exist to cartelize them, to get them to stop competing with each other so that they present this united front to increase their bargaining power. That's another buzzword that is used in the history of labor unions in this, and not only this country, but other countries as well.
But when you look back with the benefit of hindsight, I'm curious, did they actually end up suppressing their wages?
Unions?
Yes.
Well, suppressing their wages. Well, there's some argument about that. For example, maybe in collective bargaining that a union will agree to keep a wage low in exchange for something like, say, a union security contract. So in that sense, they may have been suppressing lowering wages. The other way they would be lowering wages is because unions, union workplaces are very inefficient. They work to rule. They work according to the contract, excelling, innovating, prospering is looked down on because everybody in the union should just take it easy and make the best they can out of things, given the protection that they have. So productivity goes down, so real wages go down. So in that sense, yeah, maybe they have suppressed wages. But I think a strong case can be made that in many cases they've raised wages. And they've raised wages because they have taken wages out of competition. They've cartelized the determination of wages.
So one of the things that came up, and there was a lot of controversy about it with the most recent Longshoremen's Union negotiation relative to the adoption of efficiency-enhancing technologies that you refer to in your paper, where you know they're guaranteeing certain positions to be had. It's like the old pad and pen, you know, accounting.
Right.
You just kind of scratch your head and you look at some of the most forward-leaning ports in the world that are not burdened with these challenges of a union. You know, just outperforming us here in the U.S. on almost every metric.
Exactly.
You begin to wonder, what are we doing?
What we're doing is we're catering to the longshore union. I got to watch out. When people use we, the first question you should ask is, who is we?
Who is we?
But yeah. So what I mean is, what the politicians have done in exchange for campaign contributions, among other payoffs, is to protect the longshore union against competition and against having to adapt to changing technology. It's all exchange. You know, when you want to understand what's happening in government, particularly with regard to markets, and particularly with regard to labor markets, follow the money. That's the rule. It's not new, but it's true.
Yeah. So, you know, what's interesting is that if everything was as hunky-dory as the unions want you to believe, it's amazing that they only have 5.9% of the workforce today.
Yeah, that's because the market share of the industries which they've already captured is declining as the economy turns more to service-oriented economy. And the innovation, for example, the best example is the technological innovation industry. Why would people, the get-rich-quick kids who have majored in computer science and programming and all that stuff, I mean, they're making good money. What do they need unions for? And even less obviously for many others. people make people do good jobs for themselves when they are innovative, when they work hard, when they want to demonstrate excellence, and all those things are contrary to union lore.
Yeah. Very interesting. I really enjoyed your paper. You talk about some reformations that need to be done moving forward. We've run out of time, though. But I appreciate you joining us. Thank you so much for the time and your insight.
Okay, Noel, thank you. And have
a great
day. Thank you,
sir. That's Professor Chuck Baird, Professor of Economics Emeritus at California State University, East Bay, and doing this policy paper for the Cato Institute. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line.